This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From Headstuff Studios in Dublin, welcome to Mother Folklore, a podcast about words, Irish words, and words from Ireland. Dara O'Shea is on leave. I'm your host, Padraig O'Quivonik.
I'm Geraldine McAvoy.
And we have a very special guest in studio to talk a little bit about one of the overlooked parts of our Irish cultural heritage, the food. Máirtín Mac Conamara is the first person in Irish history to get a PhD in food history. You're a chef, you're a TV presenter, you're well-travelled, and you've written quite a bit extensively about the history of Irish food and its role as a part of our cultural heritage. So I'm going to ask you the tough question first. Why is Irish food so shit?
Well, the easy answer to that tough question is that it isn't. That Irish food is actually brilliant, always has been brilliant. We always have had probably the best raw materials in the world. We didn't always appreciate them to as well as we should. But these days, and when I say these days, in the last 10, 15, 20 years particularly, there's been an absolute revolution in food in Ireland. There's always been a revolution of food in Ireland towards produce, but there's been a complete revolution in the actual production of food in restaurants and in hotels and that sort of stuff. So I think it was, I can't remember, was it 2011 or something like that, that the Guide de Routard, which was basically the French travel bible of travel, that they said that Irish food is as good, if not better, as the food of France.
There you go. Praise from Caesar.
Strong statement there.
I suppose you talk about the recent revolution in food preparation here in Irish restaurants and the likes, and you know, names spring to mind, like if you're talking Michelin star Patrick Ebo and other things, and even just thinking of stuffing on the Bib Gourmand, on that sort of mid-range stuff that I'd be a lot more familiar with than Michelin star restaurants. One of my favourite restaurants is Pichet, and I know that Stephen Gibson, when he became the first head chef at Pichet, the idea was to take Irish ingredients and serve them with a French twist. Was that the kind of thing we had to do? Did we have to stop cooking like Irish people to make Irish ingredients really shine?
No, not really. I suppose you could say that French, the French have really dominated food all over the world. You know, culturally, that most places in the Western world, up until relatively recently, if you were to identify what were the top restaurants, whether they were in New York or in London or even, you could say, Copenhagen, they would have been French or French inspired. And they would have also been the most expensive, you know, the most expensive, the most highly sought after. But there has been, I suppose it could be an anti-globalization reaction in the last number of years. It started off, you could say, with Spain, with El Bulli, and before that there was in the Basque region, you know, with the Arzak. They took the concept that Paul Bocuse started in France with just this idea about nouvelle cuisine, and they started doing nouvelle cuisine espagnole, you could say, new Spanish cuisine. And then, you know, the likes of Ferran Adrià, who is in El Bulli in Catalonia, and he had a look at the whole idea about just not copying, you know, creating. And he created a whole sort of cluster of people around him. And one of the people who worked for him there was a fellow called Renny Redzepi, who opened up Noma up in Copenhagen. And then there was this new Nordic food movement there. So they sort of came together, the Nordic countries. Like, so basically you had both Norway, Sweden, Denmark come together and sort of develop a manifesto that they would champion local food from their area and local traditions. So you could say, you know, this is sort of a reaction to that sort of, you know,
kind of reached saturation point of the haute cuisine, French
movement. Instead of being haute French cuisine that would dominate the whole world, that we would take that this new haute cuisine, that it was really local, sustainable, regional. These were, you know, championing the best foods and tradition as well. And that was the whole idea about tradition, like the idea about foraging and all that sort of stuff. Mm. You know, you could say that it went nuts. You know what I mean? Where people going mad about foraging. So Jesus, sure, that's the type of things our grandparents did all the time. Yeah, you know what I mean? And there was no one fancying anything about it. You know what I mean?
There's something a bit weird about spending 120 quid for a bowl of dillisk.
Yeah.
I used to be paid a tenner a black sack for that down in Waterford every summer. So I have Ferran Adria's cookbook at home, not the gastronomic one, but the food he used to cook for his staff, the family meal. And basically what he does in that one, you probably read it yourself, it's amazing. He just takes the concept of gastronomy and taste and all of the different parts that make up a good meal, and he sort of puts it down to something simple that he can serve his staff before they go and serve the foams and the airs to the paying customers. So at its heart, it's really good, tasty food based on good ingredients. I mean, in the Irish context, we actually really do have those good ingredients. You know, what puts such a premium on Irish ingredients around the world? Why is the beef so good? Why is the butter so good? What makes it so sought after?
Well, both the beef and the butter have the same answer, and the answer is grass, and the answer is rain. You know what I mean?
So we've got rain. Yeah,
you know, the rain got the grass.
Yeah, it's all really down to climate. You know, the thing that quite often we give out about, and, you know, a soft day, thank God, or this, that, or the other, or we're always constantly talking about the weather. That is the one factor that makes our beef and our butter and our milk and everything so wonderful, because basically grass grows nearly all year round, which means that you can actually have your cattle, now whether they're beef cattle or whether they're dairy cattle, so hence your butter or your beef, you have them out on grass. Mm. So not only are they grass fed, but they're also self-fed, which is another important thing, because people talk about feed miles, right? Or people talk about food miles.
Yeah.
And the whole idea about food miles is about, you know, I mean, the fact that you're eating local and all that sort of stuff. But there's also a thing about feed miles. Like, there's no point eating beef that comes from down the road if they're actually being fed on corn that's been shipped, or soy or something else, and sorghum that's been shipped from South America.
The overall carbon footprint of your food. Because as an environmentalist, I try and stay environmentally conscious. It drives me crazy when people go mad for, like, oh, I found these vegetables with no plastic on them, isn't brilliant? But you're like, they're shipped in from Peru. So, you know, you kind of have to look at the holistic picture.
Yeah, but the holistic picture is difficult as well, because, like, the, you know, the trouble with all of this is that we all want to do the right thing if we know what the right thing is, you know? Yeah. For example, you know, there's the whole debate about whether it's more environmentally sustainable to, I remember I was at a conference over in Oxford a number of years ago, and people were talking about this whole idea about sustainability and that, and someone was saying, is it more sustainable and it's more sort of ethical to eat lamb from Oxford or lamb from New Zealand that's been brought into Oxford? And basically they were figuring out that whichever way the lamb was produced in New Zealand, it was better to bring it in, and that was nearly as sustainable, or maybe even more sustainable.
Even though it's got a 14-hour flight to land in Oxford.
Well, it's probably by boat, you know what I mean, with dirty diesel or whatever, so we say nothing.
But the
flip side of that is, you know, the flip side of that was the idea about, you know, it's probably better to be eating a tomato that was grown in a glass house in the Canary Islands and flown in, because the glass house was only heated using the sun. Whereas if you have a tomato that was grown in a glass house up in North County Dublin, there could have been diesel heating the glass house there as well as the sun, because we don't have enough sun. You know what I mean? So it's just, unfortunately, you know, life is confusing sometimes. Yeah. And the more, you know, like this whole, there was this Eat Lancet report recently, you know, where everyone was talking about, you know, stepping away from beef and stepping away from dairy and stepping away from this. Like, I don't see anything sustainable in stopping drinking milk in Ireland when our cows are here, and then suddenly bringing in soya milk, or any of these, coconut milk, almond milk.
Apparently, almond is the worst for like carbon footprint, because almond farms in California have destroyed natural orange groves. They've destroyed the water system. They're causing droughts in California. They're putting farmers off their land all to create almond milk. So
and the same, that there was issues with quinoa over in South America, when suddenly certain products become sort of faddish in one part of the world, then what was maybe a normal natural food in a place suddenly gets priced out of the local audience and that sort of stuff. And there's all sorts of issues. So food is a complicated issue.
So, Martin, you mentioned about Irish products being really sought after, like our butter and our beef. And it always gives me a little bit of pride when I'm abroad and I see like Kerry Bowls in a fridge somewhere and it's really expensive. I'm like, yeah, we did that. But why historically then has Ireland had such a weird relationship with food? Like, we're not known for our food. I mean, you'll see an Irish pub, but you're not going to see an Irish restaurant. We have a strange relationship. While we do make good quality ingredients, we don't necessarily make them into good quality. No, I'm not saying they're not good quality, but we don't necessarily have a reputation for being good at food.
I'll tell you what we always had a reputation for was our hospitality. Okay. So I think if we start there, we've always been renowned for our hospitality. You know, we always say it's tushka duchna scale. You know, people, someone comes into your house, someone comes anywhere, wherever. We're never happy until we actually have a drink in someone's hand, whether it's an alcoholic drink or a cup of tea or whatever. And also maybe a hang sandwich or whatever. the idea is, that's it. You've done your job. It's in our DNA, hospitality, as in making sure that actually you, a stranger or someone new comes in, that you give them something to drink, something to eat, something to drink, grant. Now, you're correct in that we didn't historically, depending on how far back you go, but this idea about have that tradition. And I would sort of make the case that part of that comes from when food stopped being food and started to be a commodity.
Okay.
And what happened is we became so good at beef and at butter that we have been exporting it. Basically, we've been exporting it, globally for over 400 years. Mm-hmm. And when it became a commodity, then it stopped from being part of the national diet to being actually a cash crop that people kept and saved and valued and sold, and they were able to pay the rent. So in some ways it's part of colonialization, isn't that we had to actually do without so as to pay the rent to the landlords by stopping. We could see that the consumption of butter in Ireland reduced radically once this happened. The same, we don't really talk about beef in the same way, because in Ireland, historically, we didn't have a great, our cattle were revered for their milk and their butter and their cheeses. And when I talk about cheese, people, this is again one of the misconceptions, is people think that Ireland has no rich cheese history until, Gina Ferguson or any of these people came down to West Cork and started, making Malines or Durris or any of these, these cheeses in the 60s. But like going back centuries, going back to Aisling MacCunglin from the 13th century or whatever, we have we have evidence of 30 different types of cheeses, between ferments and rough milks and semi-rough.
Queen Maeve was killed with a ball of cheese, wasn't she? A roll of hard cheese.
Yeah, Tonnach was the name of the hard cheese.
But so it's kind of like the Irish whiskey scenario, that for many centuries, for many years, we had hundreds of distilleries producing the finest whiskey. Pre-Prohibition in America, we had the largest market share of whiskey over there. And then we just centralized everything, and everything went down to three or four distilleries, and everything became bland. It became samey. And now, only now in recent years, are we starting to see a revival of the craft distilleries and the different types of whiskies and the different grains being used and the different methods of distillation. Are we seeing that in our produce, particularly our cheeses, I'm thinking? Because like that, I'd have grown up on Calvita.
I thought you were going to say a group on Paddy.
Well, I'm not allowed to say that anymore. Apparently, there's no statute of limitations on child abuse.
we'll start with the whiskey, because the whiskey thing is quite interesting, because it's not quite as simplistic. Because what happened really, as in, you had Prohibition, which you mentioned, but also you had a thing, you had a thing called independence, as in that, 1916, 1921, 1922, we broke away from the British Empire. And one of the things that made whiskey, Irish whiskey, such a global leader was that basically every officer's mess, every officer's tent would have a bottle of Irish whiskey in it all over the world. Okay, so suddenly
so we lost our biggest customer when the British Army were
we lost our biggest customer because our biggest customer suddenly says, Jesus, what are we buying all this Irish whiskey for when they're after having fighting with us and throwing us out, sort of thing?
And we have
so,
the Scots,
and we have the Scots who are still loyal, so we stick with them. And then what happened then, as I say, with the prohibition was that, well, two things happened. You know, they say actually that John F. Kennedy's father came over.
Joseph P. Kennedy,
and he contacted De Valera and he basically wanted a deal because he got word that the prohibition was stopping and he wanted to have product ready for when it stopped. And he came over and he came to Ireland first, and the Irish government wanted nothing to do with him because basically he says, Asher, that's an Anglo-Irish Protestant business. That's not Irish and local. Right? So what did he do? He goes over to Scotland and he signs a deal over there with the biggest producers over there, and suddenly they had stuff ready then, ready to go, and then overnight they took over, you know, the industry, and we never got it back. Like, we're literally only at something like 5 or 6% or something like that. It's ridiculous. Like, but you know, we're, as you said, it's the fastest growing. With cheese, it's slightly different because what we did is we had this cheese tradition. Now, the cheese tradition was cheese in all manners, because we talk about basically, as we say, blahoch, you know, buttermilk. We talk about rough cheese, different types of cheese, like cottage cheese, all sorts of type, yogurt, all that sort of stuff. There was all these different traditions, but they sort of disappeared. And with the disappearance of it, then a new industry came in with sort of the food corporations and the food, the cooperatives.
Yeah.
And next thing around the 50s, they started developing this sort of plastic cheese. You could say, you know, the Calvita, we can all think about that. You know, the cheese suddenly came in triangles or something like that. You know what I mean?
Stephen Roach is a lot to answer for.
So, you know, you had the Galti, and the Calvita and all this sort of stuff. And then later on, Easy Singles. And then later on, you know, we actually talk about innovation. Like, you know, they were really driving innovation and the idea about cheese strings. You know what I mean? Like, how can
appealable cheese.
Yeah, you know, how can you make cheese look cool, sort of thing? You know what I mean? So if suddenly that's what people think cheese is, you know what I mean? You know, I always think that, like, life is, and history, particularly into history, you just see that actually life is just, it's a number of cycles, and you see the same things, problems, opportunities, everything sort of appear and reappear, and we tend to make the same mistakes or very similar mistakes, and hence the importance of actually studying history. So hopefully you don't make the same mistakes.
Speaking of history, obviously one of the greatest one of the first things people learn about Irish history is that we suffered on Gortha Mór, and part of the problem, obviously not the only problem, was the failure of the potato crop because of blight, and we were so dependent on the potato crop. Now, of course, it's a multifaceted part of history. We were actually exporting a lot of food at the time. That didn't stop. We weren't allowed to hold on to our own. There's so many different things to it, but we were very reliant on the potato since it came in, because the potato is a plant that'll give you, it's easily grown, it'll give you all of your nutrients, you can survive on potatoes alone. I suppose my question as a food historian, I want to go back beyond that, because one thing we don't know growing up, we don't learn it in history books or anything like that, what did we live on before Walter Raleigh and other explorers brought back the potato from South America?
We lived on milk.
The skin must have been off. Yeah.
We basically did live on milk as such, as in, you know, you go back to, no, not milk alone, because we also had oats and barley, and we also had, you know, naturally we had meats and the rest of it, you know, but milk was what we call the white meats, which are these bonvia, you know, the butter, the milk, the curds of different shapes. They were the essence of the Irish diet. Now, linked in with porridge, you know, oats, as done in like a brochan or a letze or whatever, done with oat cakes, all that sort of stuff, done with sort of flatbreads and all that sort of stuff with made from barley and from wheat and the rest. Now, we didn't really have it was flatbreads because we didn't have a tradition of leavened bread.
Yeah.
It was really, that came in with the Anglo-Normans and the idea about the built-up oven and that sort of technology. And even when,
so
you know, one of the
basically
things
we were doing griddle cakes over fire.
Making griddle cakes and that, and then sort of drying them sort of, there was these little griddle stands that you could get near the fire, and they would dry the oat cakes and that sort of stuff. And then they could be carried out into the field, and, you know, they were sort of, you know, when you're working out the field, you can, there were your picnic sort of thing. But, you know, naturally we had fish and naturally we had the pig has always been a huge part of the diet. You know, bacon particularly because there's a way, because we're talking about pre-refrigeration and all that sort of stuff, so there's a way of preserving food. And also then naturally, you know, lamb and, or, well, actually mutton was, lamb is sort of quite a modern thing. Mutton, you know, was the flavour. We like the flavour of old sheep. Plus, why would you kill a lamb? The whole idea is that meat meat was a secondary source from sheep, like wool was the main thing.
You want to get a couple of winters, you know, out of the wool first, yeah.
You know, and wool was huge. You know, this is, I think we forget this, that wool was the absolute, like, you know, we think now about sort of the smart economy and this sort of stuff, like wool and sheep back then was the Googles and was the was the Apples and all of the day.
So if you wanted to start a startup, you just got yourself a yo and
you got yourself a few yos, you know what I mean? Yeah. You only needed the one ram, but you need a good few. Yeah.
Well, if the ram was up for the job.
Hey guys, my name is Tom Moran and I am the host of Personality Bingo, an alternative interview podcast on the Headstuff Podcast Network. The premise is simple. It's 60 minutes on the clock, 60 balls in the bingo machine and 60 corresponding questions. From anything from, do you believe in ghosts? Do you cry often? And have you ever had a near-death experience? The guests are really wide-ranging, from actors, comedians, songwriters. We've had it all. If that sounds like something that would be up your street, come and check out Personality Bingo with Tom Moore.
So on top of the food, so we had these meats and these. How do we cook it back then? Because I know one thing you do actually learn, and this is a term that maybe not everybody's heard, but a fullocht fia was one way of doing it.
Yeah. And again, sometimes there's some confusion about the fullocht fia as well, because, like, you know, there's a bit of drama about the fullocht fia, you know, and we sort of tend to link it with the fianna and that sort of stuff. And the idea about even the fia being a deer, and that you could actually cook a whole deer or a whole beast or a whole animal in these fullocht fia. And for those who are not familiar with the fullocht fia, it's basically a pyrotechnology. In that you would dig a hole in the ground, normally near a stream. You would line it with wood or with stones. You would bring in, so you'd fill it up, so it naturally fill up with the water course.
So you just divert the stream.
You divert the stream into the hole as such, and then you would build a fire beside it, and you would have stones in the fire. So you would heat the stones so the stones were really hot. Then you would wrap your meat in normally straw or stuff like that, and put it into the or you'd probably you could either put it into the hole with the water and then heat it up gradually with the hot stones, or else you'd put it in, you'd bring the water up to the boil using hot stones, put in your meat, and then gradually by adding another hot stone from the fire every 5-10 minutes, you'd be able to maintain
regulate the temperature
as such, you know. But there's a lot of discussions about those fullocht fia as well, that were they used also for brewing? Were they used also? There was another flip of it, because that there's natural lime that would come off the stones, and as that lime would react with the fat of the animals, it would create soap. And then the whole idea of then that people would use them afterwards for nearly like saunas, you know, so that they'd
go in. Oh my God, I love this!
So,
I'm down with this. Anything, cooking and washing in one pot.
Absolutely.
I'm going to take this info back to Finland and tell them to shove their
son is leaving. So, you know, because all you needed then is actually you created a sort of a bit of a roof, a portable roof on top of this, and you had the steam, you had the whole lot, you know, you had the natural soap there as well, you know what I mean? So,
but particularly in winter times, you know, if you were out and about and cooking beside the stream and all that, you'd want to stay warm. So it seems like it sort of covered all the bases.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, but, you know, since the amount of work that went into it, you would imagine that it would only be for sort of ceremonial or special festivities, you know what I mean? It wasn't that every day, all right, what do we have for dinner today, man? All right, dig a hole there, you know what I mean? Sort of thing,
I just have to divert the river.
Yeah, because, like, literally we have this, you know, an awful lot of cultures have this, you know, you have the clam bakes over in America, and you have, in, you know, the hangies over in New Zealand and down South America. They have other similar types of sort of technology as such, you know. Yeah. So there's nothing sort of, you know, these these traditions are found in, most traditions are actually found in cultures all over the world, just they're slightly different.
Yeah, so it seems on the surface of it then that Fionn agus na Fianna weren't going out with their shovel and digging a new Fulloch Fia every single day and no matter what the story, it sounds like a lot of work for
a Tuesday. Do you know
when you just want to, I just want a ham sandwich.
Had a long day, guys. I'm not going to build a Fulloch Fia.
But see, they always had, you know, they always had their bag of hazelnuts with them, you know, and they'd be picking the slow berries or the rowan berries or the blackberries or whatever was in season. You know,
I mean that brings us to foraging, and we have kind of come, you know, full circle in that foraging is now, as you mentioned earlier on, it's top of the list when it comes to 2 Michelin and 3 Michelin star restaurants. Mm-hmm. You're looking at Noma pioneering it in Copenhagen, but I mean, foraging is as old as the hills. Like I used to pick Dillisk and
you're not quite old as the hills.
But I remember, like, I would have learned it off my grandmother, who's still with us. She's in her 90s, and she did it. And going back generations down in Waterford on the south coast, they pick Dillisk, dry it out, big bags, into town, sell it. But I mean, that sort of thing hasn't quite hit the. Maybe it's hit the haute cuisine, and maybe it's still down in the we look back in our cultural memory. I remember you were quoted in an article in the Dublin Inquirer last year about Winkles and how unpopular they are, and yet they used to be huge.
Periwinkles.
Yeah.
I know the word.
I know this one. They're little gastropods.
So basically, they're shells. One shell as such. So basically, they're like a small snail, you could say.
Okay.
Right, and you would eat them nearly the same way as an escargot, isn't that? You normally need a special thing to pull them out or whatever. We use normally a little pin or something like that. Yeah. But they're absolutely gorgeous. But what's interesting about the Winkles is that still the tradition of the Winkles is still alive and well down in Kilkee in County Clare. So down at Kilkee, on the seafront, there's actually two competing stalls selling cooked Winkles and Dillisk, right? So there's little pockets. And this is interesting because actually when we did the Blasta programme for TG Cahir there last year.
That was the one where you travelled around the country, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, so we went to 8 different parts of Ireland and we were looking at what is the local, you know, number one, is there sort of a local food culture in a regional food culture, you could say, and is there different pockets, you know, because people get confused and they have this sort of notion that Ireland doesn't have a food culture in the first place without talking about having a regional food culture.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is when you do travel around, you start seeing the various different traditions and the different names, like we're talking about mother folklore and the different terminology, like you're talking there down in Waterford and in Ryan. I think it's a truscal or trusker that they call seaweed down there. I hadn't heard that term down there for sort of seaweed, and even to do with periwinkles, yeah, we call them fuichen in Connemara, but they call them mungon down in Kerry, you know, and this is
the same species,
exact
separated,
same,
separated, you know, by more or less one piece of water, like just the other side of the Shannon Estuary.
You know, in the same way as we think about what we call a runnoch, like mackerel be mackerel down in Kerry, would be runnochy in Connemara, and would be, oh Christ, I'm after forgetting the name of it now. There's another name for it up in Donegal, Morlus, I think they call it up in Donegal. So that for the same fish. That, you know, we talk about a wealth of language, that we have 3 different words in the Irish language and probably more, you know what I mean? That's just in 3 different dialects there going. But sorry, when we travelled around with Blasta, you know, to see, you know, the drisheen and the tripe or stuff down in Cork, you know, to come and to have the blah and the beautiful oysters, Hearty's oysters, and we had Dillisk actually down in Portlaoise. And, Dublin, like nowhere, the only place that does coddle is Dublin.
Yeah.
Right? You know.
It's always saying that.
It is not always saying that. I am fighting the good fight, Awartin, on behalf of coddle. It's one of my favourite dishes. And I don't have a problem. I have no problem at all.
Oh, you'd know Derek wasn't here. Yeah, exactly. Oh,
Derek,
God.
Our usual host, Derek O'Shea, is on leave at the moment. It would be wrong of me to say that he hates coddle. Because he's never tasted it.
Yeah.
He actually refuses to taste
it. But see, this is it.
He hates the idea of coddle. And that's the bit that I will rail against.
That's because he hates the idea of Dublin.
If anybody, he's from Rathfarnham.
All right. I thought there was Kerry connections there.
Deep back and gone. Yeah, right. Years back. So I don't have any problem. If somebody has a bowl of coddle and says, that's disgusting, I never want to have that again. Fair enough, you've tried it, fair play to you. But there just seems to be this sort of pushback against this particular working class Dublin staple.
It's not the working class, it's just boiled fucking sausages looking at me. But
there's loads, listen, there's loads of cultures that boil their sausages.
Of course there is.
Yes, there is, but it just looks sad. It just looks really sad. Well, that's my problem.
I'm in the same church as you now, because I've been trying to promote the coddle all over for years. And I remember I did a cooking demonstration almost 10 years ago down in the Fianna GA Club in Glasnevin there, and had around 150 people in. I had a big pot, but I used cocktail sausages so that there'd be a sausage for everyone when I was doing the tasting and all that sort of stuff. And I remember, one of the mammies coming around, she says, Jesus, I looked down, it's like a plate of boiled willies.
Yeah.
You know the nickname, the Dublin nickname for the sausage and the coddle is the widow's memory.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. But actually, what's interesting about the coddle and this idea about the locality of it, right? There was it might be going back nearly 20 years ago, where the Irish Prison Service decided they were going to do something about the food, and they were going to make sure that each prisoner in Ireland had proper nutrition, and they were going to work nutrition into the menus and develop a cyclical menu. And they came up with all this plan. And there was nearly a revolution because they had coddle on, say, a Tuesday, right? Now, everyone in Mountjoy and in Wheatfield and everywhere else, they wanted coddle 3 days a week, okay?
But not where I thought that was going.
Right? But down in Portlaoise and in Limerick and elsewhere, they nearly went on hunger strike because it says, we're not eating that. That is Dublin stuff. You know, so it's fascinating. You know, it really is fascinating. You know,
what's outside of you grew up in Dublin, so you like coddle. I like coddle.
Yeah, but I grew up in Dublin, but because my parents aren't from Dublin, I didn't grow up eating coddle.
All right, okay.
And this is the problem.
My dad's not from Dublin, but he fell in love with coddle at a young age.
Yeah, yeah.
And passed it on.
Got him when he was.
They
young,
got him.
Yeah.
They got him young. They got him at about 16.
Yeah. And the first time I saw coddle, I says, I was like yourself now. I said, Jesus, I don't want to eat that stuff. You know what I mean? And part of what made me eat it was that there was a French chef visiting a friend of mine's house, and it was Rory O'Croher. His mom made the coddle. And I had to, your French chef is tasting this, I have to taste this. And once I tasted it, that's once you get over that,
it's
once you actually try
experience.
It, it's gorgeous. Like, it's just absolutely stunning. And I never went back, you know.
No, I did. I actually, the only food program I've ever appeared on was on TG Car. It was a series called Be a Hookish. And they asked five of us who liked coddle to turn up and just give, we met in Mulligan's on Pilbeg Street.
Just turn up
midday.
And explain yourself.
Just turn up and eat coddle and talk about the coddle and your memories of coddle. So we all rocked in, five lads with beards from Dublin, all Gaelgory, and we all rocked into Mulligan's at Poolbeg Street at 12 o'clock. But the chef was delayed because they were filming two episodes a day. So the chef was delayed down in Monkstown talking about seafood or something. So she wasn't able to make it for another hour. So they said, do you want a pint? So we'll have one. So we had a pint, and then we had four or five pints. And then the producer came in and said, she'll be another hour. Do you want another pint? I said, okay, we'll stretch to two. So we had another four or five pints. So by the time it came around and we all we did our piece to camera and we spoke about the coddle and we ate the sausages and we ate the potatoes and everything. It was lovely. It was great. And we had a few more pints. We all went home. A few months later, it was broadcast and I was there watching it with my wife going, look, this is my bit. And they just used one wide shot of the five of us eating coddle and then they cut straight to the next scene. We were way too pissed to talk about coddle. But I'll say one thing, after a feed of pints, there was nothing better than that bowl of coddle that they sat in front of me.
I don't know if that's a winner for. So I don't drink alcohol, so I've never had a kebab because I don't drink alcohol, because anything on a sweaty meat stick, I don't want it. Thanks. No thank you. If it's just a rotisanal sweaty meat stick, no thank you. Taco Bell, that's for drunk people, that's not for sober people. So if you're like, oh yeah, it's great after a feed of pints, I don't know if that's
it's also great on a very cold winter's day.
But actually, talk about after a feed of pints, there's a great logic behind coddle, because coddle was always what they called a Friday night dish, but it was Friday night, Saturday morning dish. Because the idea was that the lads went out to the pub on a Friday night. By the time they'd rock back home, it would be after midnight. So technically it would be Saturday. So technically on Friday, you only had to eat fish. You couldn't eat meat. So there was a pot of coddle waiting for them on the thing and they'd lash into it. Do you know what I mean? So
great,
it was
soul kitchen that.
No, but it's that if you look at another culture, if you look at the Jewish culture and the whole link of Judaism with sort of casseroles and that sort of stuff, the idea is that they can't work on the Sabbath. So by actually making
you
the
slow
meat,
cook something.
By making, putting all the food together into the casserole and then putting that into a slow oven, that's cooking. You're not cooking. You're not working. The oven is doing the work for you, doing the slow cooking. Yeah. And that's that tradition. So again, you know what I mean? You can see these sort of cultural things. When you look at them, when you ask some deeper questions, you see the patterns.
So you mentioned quite rightly there, fish on a Friday used to be a big thing. But now, if you speak to the majority of Irish people, the only experience they have of fish is it's rectangular and it's in batter and you get it with chips and salt and vinegar. We used to eat a lot more fish than we do.
Yeah, we did and we didn't. Yeah. So this is always confusing, you know what I mean? Because I have gone through a lot of the records and stuff like that and archaeological digs and all this sort of stuff. And they figured now that I don't think we ever ate more than 5% of our diet was ever fish. Now, naturally, there would be, that's the average.
Mm, yeah.
That naturally,
obviously, if you lived in a coastal area,
you'd have a lot more and all that sort of stuff.
If you lived in Athlone, you would never see a mackerel.
Not a mackerel, but plenty of salmon probably or stuff from the trout or perch or whatever, bream. But the rest of it, the issue, they're able to, archaeologists now can actually analyse our bones, and they can tell from our bones what our diet was and all that sort of stuff. So the way I look at it, people always ask, and it does make sense, like we're an island nation surrounded by seas. None of us, we're never more than 100 miles. No part of Ireland is more than 100 miles from open water sort of thing. And without talking about the number of lakes and rivers. But I would sort of argue that the reason we didn't eat so much fish is that we didn't have to. We had so much other. Again, it goes back to the rain and the grass and the cows
and the bull of a Bivon.
Do you know what I mean? Like, why would you, when you have all this other stuff, why would you?
It's a lot of effort to catch a fish.
That is the other side of it.
Inherently dangerous. Like, the Atlantic Ocean is really dangerous. When you've got a grand lamb in there, which is grand.
And you also need technology, you also need boats and nets and all that sort of stuff.
That is one thing, like, it's a common criticism, is like, why did so many people die during the famine? You're surrounded by water and you just go, do you own a boat? Most people do not own a boat. It's not that easy to just go and
even
get fish.
Even those who did own boats and even those who did have nets, one of the first things they quite often did after the first year of the famine is that they sold them to get enough money to buy seed potato for next year, because they didn't know it was going to go on for 5 years.
Of course,
do you know what I mean? So they thought this is just a blip. But there's another flip side to that. And the flip side to that is, like, there was no place to safely land a boat up until the Congested Districts Board started doing their work around the 1870s, 1880s,
1890s.
There was no piers. Like, Nemo, not Finding Nemo, but Nemo, the engineer, built all of these piers all along the Western Seaboard and all the congested districts, which suddenly made fishing an option. There was a safe place to actually, bring a boat in, land a boat. Going further back, after the Battle of Kinsale, there was a ruling that no Irish person could own a boat over a certain size, because they did not want Ireland to develop their own navy, because, Britannia ruled the waves or waved the rules, whichever way you look at it. But that was what gave England its strength and its power. And what's interesting as well is that, even though Henry VIII broke with the church, even Elizabeth, his daughter Elizabeth I, she realised the importance of fishermen towards manning the British Navy when battle happened. So she actually kept that it should be fish on Friday, even though they'd broken with Rome and all that sort of stuff, because she wanted to keep the British fishing fleet strong, because she needed sailors for when they went to war.
Wow.
So all of these things, these things aren't necessarily...
So if it wasn't for fish on a Friday, the Spanish Armada might have won.
That's it, absolutely. Yeah.
And then we'd all be eating paella and tapas and amon ibérico.
People say that actually the reason we actually eat potatoes is because the Spanish Armada didn't win, because there is a school of thought that actually some potatoes that had been on board some of the Armada ships, like, were actually washed ashore, that people took them and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. And it's the same reason people from Connemara have dark hair and sallow skin.
I think it wasn't just
the potatoes that washed up.
I think we figured that one out now from the Human Genome Project, because actually, there was a mini ice age, and anyone in the north of Europe sort of retreated down to sort of north of Spain, and in the move back up, some of them now we realise actually with that you know, maritime technology did come up by boat, so it wasn't just waiting on a land bridge coming over. So some did come by sea, and so hence the genes. Yeah, hence the genes. There's such, even if you go down to the Basque region, you'll see it's like looking at Connemara, lads. You know what I mean? It's
So let's just put Garadine off a holiday to Pamplona. Yeah, no, like, not interested anymore.
She's not into boiled sausages now. Our Connemara lads, you know.
You can't boil a chorizo at least instead. So what's the future looking like for Irish food, for Irish cuisine? What's what do you reckon of the are we going to be mentioned in future years? We're going to be mentioned along with the Japanese and the Danes and the Catalans and the Basques and the French.
I'm very hopeful that actually they're going to forget about all of those and they're going to be just talking about us. You know what I mean? Because I really believe that within the next 10 years that Ireland will have become an absolute global food destination for foodies, you know, for food tourists. I want to say real, not just normal food tourists, but those sort of high-end food tourists. Mm. Because what we have is we have a whole young generation of really, really talented chefs out there. A lot of them are working in Ireland at the moment, but a lot of them are actually working abroad at the moment, but planning on coming home. Mm. You know, people who've worked up, lads like Kuan Green and all who've been up in Noma, Louise Bannon, loads of them all over the place, you know what I mean, who've worked in all these different places, who are now wanting to come home and open up their own place. Lads like Mark Moriarty, who won the San Pellegrino Young Chef of the Year back, I think, 2015 or so. Mm. You know, he's been off in Australia. He's back. He's back in the greenhouse, but I'm sure he's plans for opening up his own place in due course. Mm. And that'll all happen. You know what I mean?
Is the obvious thing that's affecting almost everybody, particularly in Dublin at the moment, is property prices and rent on places. Is that going to affect young chefs?
It is, but if you actually have a look at the trends, if you have a look at what's happened, some of the last three latest Michelin star restaurants that are open now, all three of them were down in Cork. But they were opening.
You say naturally.
No.
I stand by that.
Well, actually, the Cork really needed some Michelin stars because they hadn't had Michelin stars in so long. You know what I mean? So really, they were only getting back to the equilibrium. You know. So
there's the dig I wanted, Martin. Yeah, there.
But what's interesting there is that they've opened up in small little places that they're actually small. Yeah. They do either 18 seats or 25 seats or 30, you know, no more than 30 seats. So they're manageable, and then they're working in places where they can manage the rent and they can manage without a huge staff and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, how sustainable that is now, I'm not sure. You know, and again, there's studies done that in cities that you need at least 60, if not 80 seats, you know what I mean? So that you can, so when you have peak business, that you can turn it over and turn it over so as to pay for the weekdays.
So that you can do two sittings of 40 covers and sort of rotate them.
Or even 20, two sittings of 60, or three sittings of 60. You know what I mean? Whatever, you know, the whole idea about early birds and all this sort of stuff.
Just to keep the restaurant
and keep it going.
Over.
Because, see, one of the things about a restaurant or a hotel or any of these things is that we talk about seat hours, our beds, you know, bed nights, it's perishable. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? You can't sell it again. You can't say, you know, if someone doesn't come in today, you know, you can't sell that tomorrow because that's, you only get the one chance at it. And then it's not even, we have a thing called Rev Pash, which is revenue per available seat hour. So it's how often you turn the seats, you know what I mean? And that, you know,
I'll never look at it the same way again. Yeah. But before we let you go, Martin, I have to ask you one question that's been burning my mind. What's your comfort food? What's your go-to? If you just say, I'm a little bit peckish, I'm going to put something together, what's it going to be?
Okay, my go-to comfort food, well, two of them, but mashed potato with mashed carrots and parsnips puree mixed through it.
My 8 months old son loves that as well.
Plenty of butter and then like a mixed grill, like some nice sausages and rashers. So that's one. And then the other one there would be just a good old chicken stew or a good old beef stew, again with mashed potatoes, plenty of butter in it, you know what I mean?
What are you saying, Gardaine? Yeah. What's your comfort food?
I think it'll have to be a good stew. When I've been away for a while, I come home, I just want a stew, but my mum's stew, like nobody else's stew.
It's very, very important. I'm gonna rock the trend here. It's not a big meal. It's nothing heavy. It's a toasted cheese sandwich. Can't beat it. Good Irish cheese. Solid.
Bit of mustard on it now?
Of course.
Mustard. It's all the nuance.
And as I'm trying to follow that Eat Lancet report and reduce it, I won't be going for cheese and ham. Just cheese, onion, little bit of mustard, batch bread, pint of Guinness. Oh, thanks again. On that bombshell, Martin Gramila Magadas Chak the Sack.
Falta.
Gardaine. It's a slán for us.
I guess I'll see you again.
I think we've forgotten how to end the podcast, but we'll just kill it there. Thanks a million. Iowa, slán. Mother Folklore is a podcast on the Head Stuff Podcast Network and comes out every Friday. You can get us at motherfolklore@headstuff.org for feedback, comments, queries or suggestions. Thanks as always to Brian for producing and to Kirsten Scheel for the amazing artwork. We'll be back next week. Slán.
This has been a production of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
Damien Dempsey, you know, of a few CDs out there now, you know, so you can buy them after the show. And if you don't like me, you can buy them for people you don't like. Yeah.